Welcome to the Irwin Markets Project.
This is Irwin Marcus, Professor of History Emeritus, Indiana University of Pennsylvania. The topic for today is Democratic Vistas and Defensive Unionism in District 2, United Mine Workers of America, 1919 to 1943. By looking at District 2 in this era, we not only come across a topic of significance in its own right, but also a clue to a larger topic, which is that many of the characteristics we'll talk about in regard to 1919 to 1943 are characteristics of the whole history of the United Mine Workers from 1890 to the present. We're going to talk about three aspects. One is the centralizing, authoritarian, if not dictatorial, aspect of leadership and instruction organization in United Mine Workers, embodied in the presidency of John Mitchell, Richard Trumka, and especially John L. Lewis, 1919 to 1959, 40 years, four decades of leadership by John L. Lewis. And the second component will be a look at what I call democracy, the democratic surge embodied in the program, activities, ideas, significant legacy of John Brophy, who was president of District 2, United Mine Workers from 1916 to 1926, a decade. We'll talk about Brophy's reform, progressive reform aspects as the second component. The third component will be a discussion of defensive unionism, as exemplified by the James Mark period from 1927 to 1941, and also by the strikes in the Anthracite and by two minutes in 1942 and 1943. These strikes had a dual purpose. One was to promote district autonomy. And you find this is a very strong element in District 12 in Illinois and also District 2 in central western Pennsylvania. So we're going to look at three chronological components. The long one will be 1919 to 1926 and 1927 to 1941 and then 1942 and 1943, which years of strikes and surges for district autonomy. The story begins with John L. Lewis and John Brophy. They become important figures in United Mine Workers approximately the same time. Brophy at the district level and Lewis at the national international level. They have certain common interests, promoting the development of the union, promoting the interests of coal miners, and promoting a better society for the people of the United States. Their personality is very different, however, their program is very different, however, and their contributions are very different. We won't let spend too much time on General Lewis, but I will say a few words at the beginning to set the scene for Lewis. He was interested in power for the miners, power for the labor movement, power for the country, and power for John L. Lewis as the leader of the United Mine Workers and then president of the CIL. He was a power-oriented person, interested in status, interested in being respected, interested in being a person of influence and a person influencing decision-making at the highest levels. As you look at Lewis in the 1920s, his major concern is twofold. One is maintaining the wages of the coal miners and the Jacksonville Agreement, 1924. Maintaining as much of the membership and strength and status of the union as possible, but mainly maintaining his own position against an increasing number and power of adversaries led by John Brophy, culminating in the 1926 presidential election where Brophy and Lewis ran against each other. Lewis had the good fortune of appointing the tellers who counted the votes and gave him a 2-1 majority over Brophy, who contested the election and said fraud was an important part. And many historians since that time, most, if not all, contend that Brophy won the election and Lewis stole it from him. So the 1920s for Lewis is a period when he is in difficulty with opponents in the union. He doesn't push the issues that many miners consider to be significant, including nationalization of the coal mines, coal fields. He has his own agenda. He's a business unionist. He supports Republican candidates. He supports Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, even Hoover in 32. The exception is Roosevelt in 36, by 40 he's back to Republican nominee Wendell Willkie, opposition to a third term for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The results are very different, 1920s, 1930s. There's some changes in Lewis's approach, but essentially he is a business unionist willing to use political power to enhance his interest, the interest of his union, the interest of the miners. He doesn't alter his limited agenda. Essentially, he was a protege of Samuel Gompers, and Lewis is interested in more for himself, more for the labor movement, and more for the union and for the coal miners. Brophy, on the other hand, develops a more sophisticated, broad-based, progressive program, which gets favorable coverage in the labor press, favorable responses from many coal miners, favorable responses from many union leaders and progressive politicians and progressive publicists and progressive advocates of a democratic society. One can see Brophy at an early stage of his career in 1919, and the place to see him is in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which is the site of the District 2 Iron Workers Convention. At that convention, in addition to calling for increased wages, because during the war and even more so after the armistice, cost of living increases much faster than the money wages of coal miners, calls for a substantial wage increase. But what is dramatic is his call for organizing the unorganized, increasing the size of the United Mine Workers, his call for a 30-hour work week to share the work, because after the demands, the high demands for coal during World War I, because we're not only supplying coal for our civilian population and our military needs, but also for the needs of our allies, particularly Britain and France, both civilian and military. Much of that demand is temporary, ephemeral, short-term, and by the 1920s, early 1920s, even 1919, it's clear that there's going to be a problem: overproduction of coal, too many coal mines, too many coal miners. That is going to affect the profit picture of coal companies and cause the coal company executives, managers, superintendents, foremen to pressure labor to produce more and to get less. Less money, fewer hours, fewer days of labor. So the program that grows out of the resolutions of the 1919 Johnstown Convention include a call for higher wages, a 30-hour work week, calls for organizing and unorganized, and calls for nationalization of coal mines. This nationalization measure is comparable in some ways to what's happening in Great Britain, although they're more advanced. They have a Sankey Commission, which investigates the condition of coal miners, and the Sankey Commission calls for nationalization of the coal fields. That will happen in Great Britain after World War II. It will not take place in the United States. Brophy will continue to agitate for that even in the post-World War II period, but there'll be little enthusiasm on the part of miners, the leadership of the United Mine Workers, led by General Lewis, and the federal government and the general public. So Britain, which will be in a forward position in World War I and post-World War I period, will use that as a takeoff point in the post-World War II period with Clement Attlee and Iron Bevan, the Labour Party, inaugurating nationalization of the coal fields. Back to the United States, at the 1919 convention in Johnstown, you have speakers including William Z. Foster, who's leading the steel strike, and Jim Hour, who's leading socialist and president of the Pennsylvania Federation of Labor, speaking at the convention. You have resolutions condemning the murder of Fannie Sellins, a UMW organizer. The 1919 coal strike occurs, doesn't last very long. Lewis declares that he cannot sanction an ongoing strike. A settlement is reached, which increased the wages of the coal miners somewhat through a decision by a government panel. But the other aspects, more progressive aspects of the 1919 convention in Johnstown, which is comparable to that in Cleveland for the international, calling for a 30-hour work week, organized and unorganized, and nationalization of the coal mines, does not get a very high level of priority on the Lewis agenda. He speaks in behalf of nationalization on occasion, but really doesn't push that. He's a business unionist. He's interested more in power, he's interested in more, he's interested in maintaining the Jacksonville Agreement, wages, but he's not interested in fundamental change. The Democratic impulse is reflected in a miners program developed by the Bureau of Industrial Research in New York City, which includes Arthur Gleason, who's a key conduit between Britain and the United States, both in regard to nationalization of the coal fields and workers' education. He works together with Brophy. They helps to develop the Modernist Program, which calls for organizing the unorganized, a 30-hour work week, and a National Association of Coal Mines, in which workers will have a say in how the coal mines operate. Another dimension of the democratic impulse is the 1922-1923 coal strike in Somerset Field. In this case, you have an attempt by Lewis to improve the situation of the coal miners. He supports the Somerset strike, but at a point in time, he decides that he can get an agreement for the unionized miners that will assist them, and he will leave the miners who are not unionized, who went out on strike with the unionized miners, in the lurch, bereft of support of the international, bereft of support of the national officers, such as General Lewis. At that point, John Brophy will say Lewis has sold out the coal miners. He's made a deal with the coal operators at the expense of the non-union coal miners, who have been forced into evictions and living in tents, living in makeshift dwellings, living in other places that are not fit for human habitation, chicken coops, coke ovens, and other facilities. The strike, Somerset strike, has a number of important aspects. There's a march on New York by coal miners and their families, their wives, trying to address the issues of the strike and get a wider support for their position, for their efforts, for their initiative. There's an attempt to get the subway system in New York, owned by the city of New York, to put pressure on the Berwyn family, which is the dominant family in Windber, to change their policies. That doesn't have any success. There is an attempt by Paris Hapgood to get publicity outside the coal fields, because inside the coal fields, except for a few newspapers and the publication of the District 2 United Mine Workers, there is little journalistic support for the efforts in the 1922-1923 Somerset strike. So you find miners at a disadvantage, facing not only the operators, but their political supporters, the police, coal and iron police, company guards, and injunctions. The Pennsylvania National Guard is a force that's to be reckoned with, and it's on the side of the coal companies. The governor's on the side of the coal companies, and the coal companies have major advantages in superior wealth, superior status, and superior power. The democratic surge is also embodied in the workers' education program of the United Mine Workers. I'll deal with this rather briefly. There are classes being held. There are women's auxiliaries being formed. This is undertaken under the auspices of John Brophy, beginning in 1924, lasting until 1926. Paul Fuller is appointed as the education director, and Clara Johnson is appointed as his assistant, the assistant education director. In combination, they prepare labor classes dealing with a variety of subjects. Clara Johnson is a person who assists in the formation of women's auxiliaries, convinces many women to picket on the side of their coal miner husbands and relatives. One of the key features is the Labor Chautauqua developed by Paul Fuller, which combines major speakers and local entertainment. Over 20 are held, primarily in 1925-1926. Two are held in Nanaglo, two are held in Hastings. Many other places have at least one. These are covered in the labor press and, to some extent, in the progressive press. They get local attention in the Hastings newspaper, the Nanaglo newspaper, the Sykesville newspaper, and others. They bring to this coal field of Central Western Pennsylvania, District 2, Norman Thomas, Frank Tannenbaum, Clint Golden, Jim Maurer, and a host of noteworthies. These activities are well supported and well attended. Hundreds of people come, not only the miners, but their families and their friends and other people who are interested in community improvement. Improvement of the coal miners, improvement of the local economy, the local culture. In 1926, you have the end of an era with John Brophy stepping aside to run for the presidency of the United Mine Workers International, being declared the loser, although most people say the election was stolen. James Mark, who had been vice president, replaces him and remains in control for about a quarter of a century. He becomes a Lewis advocate, a Lewis supporter. What happens now is you have a period of defensive unionism. The outreach of the nationalization of the coal mines and the outreach of the workers' education program are eliminated. Focuses on survival. This begins to turn around the early 1930s, particularly 1933 with the election of Roosevelt, the New Deal, the National Industrial Recovery Act, Section 7A, the right of workers to join unions, protected by the federal government. Coal miners take the opportunity of asserting themselves. They become union members. They go on strike. They push for improved wages, improved conditions. But this is essentially a more limited agenda. It's more successful in the 1930s than either the Lewis or the Brophy program in the 1920s. But one of the key reasons why it's more successful is not only that it's a more positive setting, with a more supportive president, more supportive Congress, eventually more supportive court system, more activity by miners, a new generation of Americanized workers who are not as much divided and fragmented and undermined by ethnic and religious rivalries and opposition, neglect. You have, in addition to the factors involved that I've just mentioned, one of the reasons for the success is they have reduced the agenda to primarily a business unionist agenda, although it's an industrial union rather than a craft union, of higher wages, better working conditions, more. At the same time, Lewis and his supporters gain control of the union. They take districts of the Nanaimo workers into trusteeship, in which Lewis appoints the president and the officers of the union, as well as the organizers. This raised the issue of district autonomy, which will be an important issue in the 1930s. Dissidents will call for democratizing the union. During the Brophy period, that was the norm. Now it is the exception, and there's a call for the democratic surge being embodied in decentralization, democratic decentralization. Lewis continues to call for centralization, views some of these initiators of reform movements as not only dissidents, but dual unionists, Reds, communists, union busters, and he disciplines them and tries to keep them in line. This is the story till 1941. At that point, we're entering into the Second World War, not only as a nation supplying assistance to the Allies, money, goods, lend-lease, destroyers, other assistance, but as an active belligerent, sending troops, planes, ships, soldiers, sailors, Marines, and others to assist our allies in defeating the Japanese, Germans, and Italians. At this point, 1942, what's going to happen is that the Unionsite miners in eastern Pennsylvania will go on strike. Their strike will be controversial. They'll pressure Lewis to support them. He won't be the leader. He'll be the person catching up with the rank and file. We're noticing that they're support for the war, buying bonds, supporting the USO, giving blood, buying war bonds, using ration stamps, limiting their automobile travel, planting victory gardens. It's insufficient. Their standard of living is being undermined. They're working longer hours, working over weekends, working on holidays. This is not appreciated sufficiently, at least in monetary terms. Their real wages are declining while others are doing much better, workers and especially executives and major stockholders. They demand an increased wage. They're met by the opposition of the World Labor Board and the other federal government agencies that are upholding a policy restricting inflation. The OPA, Office of Price Administration, is trying to control wage increases and price increases. They have much more success in controlling wages. The labor movement supports Roosevelt. Supports the war effort. Sidney Hillman is playing a crucial role. President of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. When workers go on strike, they're viewed by many as unpatriotic, un-American, dangerous, and they're under great pressure to return to work. By 1943, the strike spreads to the Bituminous area, including Central Western Pennsylvania, District 2. Again, the initiative is not from Lewis, not from Mark, but from the rank and file, local leadership, rank and file workers. They're also falling behind in their wages, maintaining their standard of living. The cost of products they buy is outpacing their increase in monetary wages. Their monetary wages are limited by the Little Slither formula, provides for a 15% increase over a base period. Workers consider this to be unsatisfactory. We notice that others are doing much better, although they're working very hard, they're working in dangerous work, they're working in important work. They call for substantial wage increase. There's intransigency on the part of Roosevelt, his administrators, National War Labor Board. Eventually, an agreement is reached. Harold Lecky serves as an intermediary at times. The agreement calls for a wage increase, but it is done in such a way that hopefully, according to the Roosevelt administration, will not set a precedent of undermining the keeping inflation under control program of the Roosevelt administration. What it does is it says that the coal miners are in an unusual position, that the entrance to their work area and their place of work are a much greater distance and much more time consuming to reach than for most workers. So their pay is similar to the dead work situation. They're not paid for work that doesn't produce coal. They're paid on a tonnage basis. So when they put up pillars and provide for their safety, they're doing that at their own expense rather than getting paid by the coal company for that purpose. They also have an additional activity, which is getting to the coal face, which can take some time, and this is non-paid work as well. So the way they get a wage increase is through portal pay. From the time they enter the mine to the time they leave the mine, it's their work period. Thus they're able to get an increase in the amount of money they receive, not by increasing their compensation per unit, but by increasing the number of units considered in formulating a wage scale and a wage return for them. 1942 strike, there were really four strikes in the Tubman's area. You can see the district autonomy issue and the opposition to Lewis as well as to the administration of Roosevelt and their unwillingness to grant miners what they consider they deserve. When Lewis and Mark call for the return of the miners to work, sometimes they go back, sometimes they delay. It shows that Lewis, although he has dictatorial authoritarian tendencies, doesn't have complete control over the miners and their decisions about work and not work. 1943 strikes are, in a sense, a pyrrhic victory for the coal miners. They get some improvements in their situation, particularly wage improvements, but they pay a heavy price. They alienate the Roosevelt administration, alienate the public, alienate the employers. Lewis is considered to be a dangerous, un-American figure to many American leaders, to many American people. Even other workers and other labor leaders are critical of coal miners and John Lewis for taking workers out on strike during a wartime situation where production is necessary for successful completion of the military objective of victory over the Axis powers. The democratic theme, the democratic urge, democratic surge, is found to continue in the United Mine Workers. However, it's a subordinate element until the late 1960s when Jack Yablonsky runs against W.A. Tony Boyle for the presidency of the United Mine Workers. Yablonsky and his family are killed. Investigations take place. It's decided to have another election. Arnold Miller is the candidate of the Miners for Democracy. He wins office and there's some democratization of the United Mine Workers. Some degree of centralization is at least temporarily reduced. Another area is the area of strikes. Strikes continue in the coal fields, striking 46, striking 49. At the same time, there's a change. Lewis decides that he has to collaborate more with the coal companies, particularly the coal companies that operate in the unionized basis. The Lewis Love Agreement is formulated that calls for coal miners to get higher wages, pensions, health care, hospitals, but the labor force will be reduced because the other side of the pie, the other side of the issue is mechanization of the coal fields, mechanization of the coal mines, and with improved technology, the need for workers is reduced. Thus we have a situation in which those who are employed are under better circumstances than before, but the number of union members, number of employed coal miners decreases significantly. In addition, there's another factor that emerges. It is that Lewis provides money for unionized coal companies to operate and to compete with non-union cooperations, both deep mines and increasingly surface mining, strip mining, which becomes more prevalent. Mines are in the West are developed with lower carbon, less pollution, or purchasing by companies. Internationalization of the coal industry. Conglomerates form that not only are coal companies, energy companies that are in coal, oil, natural gas, other areas. So what we have is a situation in which there's the interlude of John Brophy, democratic impulse, embodied in the call for a 30-hour work week, embodied in call for organizing the unorganized, a call for nationalization of coal mines. The next period is characteristic of increased union power, United Mine Workers, increased wages for miners, somewhat more stabilized circumstance. And 42, 43, the strikes, conventional approach to improving the condition of miners, improves wages, but it does that at a price. Lewis is now essentially ostracized. The miners are considered to be unpatriotic, although they view themselves as patriots who are demanding something that is necessary for themselves and their families, and their patriotism, in their opinion, should not be impugned or questioned or be subject to controversy. We also have the democratic aspect, being embodied in the district autonomy movement. The coal strikes at 2:43, in which the coal miners' directly are wrathful not only against the lack of improvement in their wage picture, but also Lewis's opposition to this autonomy. Thank you very much.